Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on January 22, 2019. This is the second week of our 2019 Truth of Happiness Dhamma study. This talk establishes Shamatha Vipassana meditation as the Buddha taught Shamatha Vipassana meditation, and also includes a talk on the proper meaning of jhana. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So this is the second week of our Truth to Happiness Dhamma study, the first chapter on incorporating Shamatha Vipassana meditation as the right meditation that the Buddha taught as one factor of the Eightfold Path. The Buddha taught only one meditation method, despite what has developed. He taught it for a very specific reason, not for contemplation, not for analysis, but for the sole purpose of deepening concentration. When the Buddha would tell people to go meditate, he'd say, go find the root of a tree or an empty hut. In other words, find a quiet, secluded spot and do jhana. Jhana means concentration, as we've covered a lot this year, talked a lot about what the Buddha means by jhana, how to specifically develop it, and what to avoid when we're doing that. And tonight's sutta, the Anapada Sutta, we'll go into that a little bit deeper. Maybe when we get to the Q&A and discussion part, we can talk about how your understanding of meditation as a concentration practice has developed, and I would bet you would agree that your meditation practice has become simpler as you've developed it, and as you developed it within the framework of the Eightfold Path. The Buddha didn't teach anything magical or mystical, meaning that he didn't teach anything that couldn't be directly experienced. The whole point of the Buddha's teaching is to unite a mind in its body. For many human beings, literally for the first time, that's the essence of the mindfulness that the Buddha taught, that a well-concentrated mind is able to hold the refined mindfulness of the entire Eightfold Path as the framework and guidance for what they're experiencing in the moment. And so as we learned even more deeply this past year, there's nothing personal about a self, except that we make it so. And we personalize our experience by fabricated views of who and what we are. So the Buddha teaches us to understand what actually constitutes a self. You remember the Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta. Every human being is made up of six impersonal and completely ordinary properties, and that's the same for everyone. It's by self-identification and personalizing those properties that we create confusion, delusion, fabricated views, and stress and suffering. So a mind united in its body sees things from an impersonal, non-clinging way. There's no I-making in it. And that results in what the Buddha teaches is the quality of an awakened mind as calm and at peace. Notice how that an awakened mind, a mind that is resting in calm and peace and equanimity, is a reflection of the deepening concentration that we develop in meditation. In other words, without a well-concentrated mind, there can be no peace. And that makes sense, doesn't it? If our minds are constantly distracted, grasping after one thought after another, there's no peace. But a mind that is well-concentrated now has the foundation to develop an understanding of what to recognize as useful mindfulness, what to hold in mind, and what is simply more distraction. Is that clear? Yes?
Yes.
Yes.
Shout it out. On one occasion, this is from the Anapada Sutta. It's a really wonderful sutta where the Buddha uses Sariputta. Sariputta came to the Buddha, him and Moggallana, at the same time. You remember the story about the two of them, maybe. Very early in the Buddha's teaching career, and very quickly, over just a few short weeks, Sariputta developed a profound understanding of the Buddha's teachings, awakened and became one of the most important monks throughout the Buddha's teaching career, throughout the 45 years of the Buddha's teaching career. And he uses Sariputta here as an example of a proper jhana practice. And in that way, it's much like the Anapanasati Sutta, where the Buddha uses a group of 22 or 24 awakened monks and nuns as an example of a proper Dhamma practice. On one occasion, the Buddha was staying in Savatthi in Jita's Grove, Anatha Pandika's monastery. He addressed those gathered. Friends, Venerable Sutta is wise. Sariputta is of great, deep, and penetrating discernment. For 2 weeks, now he's describing Sariputta's awakening experience for 2 weeks after Sariputta joined the Sangha. For 2 weeks, Sariputta, secluded from sensuality and from unskillful mental qualities, gained profound insight into unskillful mental qualities one after another. That last line is important. The Anapanasutta, the subtitle, is recognizing and abandoning fabrications one after another. And the reason why that's significant is that as we start deepening our concentration, we are able to recognize our own fabricated views of self in relation to the world one after another. And in order to do that, we have to have the proper framework, but we also have to understand that meditation, as the Buddha teaches, is not meant to analyze these fabrications or contemplate these fabrications, as is often taught, but simply to recognize them and abandon them. And it's easy to see there, isn't it, that getting into analysis or contemplation is simply using a meditation practice to continue distraction. In that way, meditation becomes a mindless practice, doesn't it? It's just the opposite of what the Buddha teaches. Sariputta entered and remained in the first jhana. And jhana means, the Buddha teaches four levels of meditative absorption, and I'll describe them here. They're not meant to be seen as meditative achievement, though. They're simply ordinary experiences that anybody practicing right meditation, shamatha vipassana meditation, within the broader framework, will experience. The reason why the Buddha is teaching it here and teaching it in many other suttas, and why I'm teaching it, is so that we recognize it, so that we're mindful of it. And that's an important aspect of developing a concentration practice, to know that what we're doing is bearing fruit, and to understand that we are deepening our concentration by recognizing these ever-deepening levels of jhana. This first jhana is characterized by rapture born of seclusion. Rapture is a little bit of an archaic term that's often applied to like the second coming or some magical or mystical experience. Here the word rapture, it simply means a direct and profoundly mindful engagement with what's occurring. Excuse me for 1 second. Someone's joining us named iPad. Welcome whoever you are. I have a device called an iPad too, but it's something's like, I'll ask you, I'll invite you online in a little bit. Jhana is characterized by rapture born of seclusion, the first level of concentration. Notice how ordinary this is, but the recognition of it develops an extraordinary practice. It's simply rapture born of sitting and meditating. Finding a secluded spot and quieting your mind by being mindful of your breath. That's and the simple recognition of that is entering the first jhana. This first jhana is accompanied by directed thought and evaluation. That directed thought simply means that we are directing our thoughts back to being mindful of what's occurring. In other words, the instructions that to recognize that you're caught up in your thinking again and come back to the sensation of breathing is directed thinking. It's directed thought, and it's evaluating what's occurring. In other words, it's putting a value judgment on whether you're doing this practice correctly. Am I recognizing that I'm caught up in my thinking and coming back to the sensation of breathing, avoiding the compulsive need to analyze or contemplate or judge the experience? It's accompanied by directed thought and evaluation. I'm caught up in my thinking, come back to the sensation of breathing. That's the first the first jhana, but it also relates directly to the Satipatthana Sutta that we're going to study next week, doesn't it? The four foundations of mindfulness begins with being mindful of the breath and the body. The qualities present in the first jhana, directed thought, evaluation, rapture, pleasure, concentration, contact, feeling, perception, intention, consciousness, desire, decision, persistence, mindfulness, equanimity, and attention, were recognized one after another. Again, the Buddha is just showing that Sariputta is well concentrated enough to recognize these different mental qualities, all fleeting, arising, and passing away during his meditation practice. And what he's pointing out, most importantly, is Sariputta is not distracted by any of them. In other words, he's not caught up in desire, he's not caught up in consciousness, meaning his ongoing thinking, and he always comes back to the sensation of breathing. This is all a process of that first jhana. Lorna mentioned a couple years ago now that she came to the development in meditation that she was viewing her thoughts as being something submerged while her breath was above here. In other words, the thoughts continued to flow, but she was mindful of her breath. That's a proper meditation practice. It's not the absence of thought. That's a trance, and that's not what the Buddha taught. It's simply not being distracted by your thoughts, and that's what the Buddha's teaching here. That Sariputta thoughts were continuing. He didn't grasp after or cling to any, and he kept coming back to the sensation of breathing. That's that pleasant first jhana, resting in seclusion, not being distracted by our thoughts. And every one of us that engages in this proper meditation practice experiences this. For most of us, in the beginning, it's very fleeting. It might last for just a breath or two. But that's why it's called a concentration practice. Every time we come back to the sensation of breathing, we're deepening our concentration, we're deepening jhana. I'm going to skip over a little bit of my comments in here. Sariputta, wise, of great, deep, and penetrating discernment, clearly saw the arising, the establishment, and the passing away of these mental qualities present in the first jhana. That's also a direct teaching on impermanence, isn't it? To recognizing the arising, the establishment, the experience of it, and the passing away of all things. And everything in our physical existence is impermanent. And by the way, everything in our mental existence, our thoughts, are impermanent. They arise, they establish themselves momentarily or for a period of time, and they all pass away.
So what's the difference between his mind and my mind? Because
Sariputta's mind and your mind?
Yeah, because I can have this like dual thinking where I'm thinking about my breath, but there's thoughts going as well. And it's kind of like a dual thinking.
Yep.
Which is fine until you start eye-making in your thoughts. So that's the time to come back to your breath. So
yes.
So I've actually gone into eye-making for a while, maybe sometimes, before I realise I'm eye-making in my thoughts, so then I come back to my breath. So is Sariputin, it can catch it before it happens, is that the difference? Is that the thought that he would go into would be an eye-making thought, so he catches it before it starts, whereas I'm sort of off on the story. Then I realize I'm on a story, then I come back to my breath. So I've kind of like made the mistake, then you're having to come back.
Yes, but please don't see it as a mistake, because the recognition of the process is part of, it's an important part.
Just to explain.
So it's just where you are. So Sarah, to answer your question, Sarah, as the Buddha will describe here, by developing jhana to ever deeper levels, does not have to catch himself doing it anymore. He's gone beyond it, and his mind just simply rests in equanimity. There's no eye-making left at that point. But along the way, and I hope I get to do the whole sutta tonight, it's rather long, so I might not finish it. Along the way is just that process of recognizing that I'm caught up in my thoughts again. Another way of describing being caught up in your thoughts is eye-making, because that's exactly what we're doing. We're caught up in our thoughts in a self-referential way. And that first jhana, directed thought and evaluation still has a component of I'm making. That's what it's referring to. I'm evaluating this. I'm judging this. Is this good? Is this bad? And it can often lead to, and not to use you as an example, except I will, to thinking, well, I just made a mistake because I'm doing this, rather than recognizing that that is exactly what should be occurring. You should notice when you're caught up in your thoughts again, because that's the only way to deepen your concentration. I'm trying to think of the right word. By the way, realistically, it's the recognition that I'm doing this right that gives you the self-encouragement to continue. It's important, and it's really one of the main reasons why the Buddha teaches this jhana practice in this way, so that we have something to hang our hat on, to recognize, yes, I am deepening my concentration. And the perfect example of that is recognizing that for the first time in your life, you're recognizing that you're caught up in your thoughts.
Mm.
And you direct yourself to come back to the sensation of breathing. And as you'll see here, as we continue this simple practice of being mindful of the breath, our concentration naturally deepens. So what an important question. Thank you. Let me just go back one sentence. Sariputta, wise of great, deep, and penetrating discernment, clearly saw the arising, the establishment, and the passing away of these mental qualities present in the first jhana. He noticed how these qualities arose, came into play, and vanished. That simple experience, mental experience, is also the physical experience of a human life. An entire human life comes into existence, comes into play, and it vanishes. Do you see the connection between a concentration practice and understanding a human life? Because it's a microcosm of our life. And when we can do that on our cushions in an impersonal way, we can do just what the Buddha taught, to take that off our cushions and realize the complete impersonal nature of a human life.
So Sariputta can experience the hindrances for what they are. They're impermanent and they don't make up the self, so therefore he doesn't need to attach himself to anything.
Yes, what another great point. And so because of that, there's no desire left in Sariputta or any awakened, I wouldn't say awakened even, developing Dhamma practitioner. And as we learned in many suttas, including the Loka Sutta, where there's desire, there's fear. And because fear results from eye-making, and desire can only arise from a distracted mind lacking understanding of what it is.
Is that
fabricated mind?
Is that also where Sariputta starts experiencing the seven factors of enlightenment?
From that point, yes.
From that point.
From that point, yeah. Boy, that's a great... It's another great point. There are seven factors, and I won't get into that tonight because it's really another teaching, but the Buddha teaches both in the Satipatthana Sutta and the Anapanasati Sutta that a well-concentrated mind, developing the refined mindfulness to hold in mind the Eightfold Path, then can develop these seven factors that are required to actually awaken. And again, awakening is not anything magical or mystical or otherworldly. It simply means that we develop full human maturity. We understand who and what we are in relation to the world without the need for it or ourselves to be any different. Okay. Sorry about that. Having entered in the first jhana, rapture born of seclusion, accompanied by directed thought and evaluation, Sariputta remained free of attraction or aversion in regard to these qualities. He remained independent, detached, released, dissociated, and free of any barriers arising from attraction or aversion. I'm going to skip over that. I hope that's not too confusing, but it'll become obvious what it means. Having entered into the first jhana, Sariputta understood there is deeper concentration. He pursued this path and realized deeper concentration. So the Buddha's making the declarative statement there that as Sariputta continued his concentration practice, he eventually realized the culmination of the goal. He realized deeper concentration. Sariputta, secluded from sensuality and from unskillful mental qualities, with the stilling of directed thoughts and evaluations, entered and remained in the second jhana. This second jhana is characterized as rapture and pleasure now born of concentration. So it's not significantly different than the first jhana, is it? And it's not meant to be. It's not, again, this is not achievement. It's simply recognizing that we begin our meditation practice, and at first we take pleasure and comfort out of just the seclusion, out of disentangling ourselves from the world for a few minutes and becoming mindful of our breath. And as that experience deepens our concentration, we now recognize, as Lorna just described, my mind is becoming more concentrated. And there is skillful pleasure in recognizing that, and we should recognize it. Again, because it's self-encouragement to continue our practice. Has everyone experienced those first two levels of jhana?
Yes.
Pleasure born of seclusion, pleasure born of concentration.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. Brief, but yeah.
Yeah, the length of time doesn't matter. What's important is that you've had the recognizable experience of it. That's all. And so when you realize, that's a pretty profound understanding. And the reason why I asked that question is so you all understand the profound nature of your practice. You are experiencing exactly what Sariputta experienced, exactly what the Buddha's teaching. You're doing it right. And it's not that difficult, is it? No. The Buddha continues, the mind united in the body, free of directed thought and evaluation, it's an internal assurance. Again, self-encouragement. It's internal assurance. We know that we're doing something. We know we're engaging in right meditation, and it's having the effect that we hope to get, an internal assurance. Do you see how that's self-encouraging to continue with our Dhamma practice? And it really is the essence of the Buddha's teaching, that this is a Dhamma that we must and will have a direct experience with, because that's the only way it works. It's not, in other words, it's not somebody telling us, whether through doctrine or scripture, that we should be a certain person. We become the person that we're supposed to be through direct experience, by recognizing that it's actually occurring. The qualities present in the second jhana, internal assurance, directed thought, evaluation, rapture, pleasure, concentration, contact, feeling, perception, intention, consciousness, desire, decision, persistence, mindfulness, equanimity, and attention were recognized one after another. Again, that same process of simply recognizing what's arising and passing away. Sariputta, wise, of great, deep, and penetrating discernment, clearly saw the arising, the establishment, and the passing away of these mental qualities present in the second jhana. He noticed how these qualities arose, came into play, and vanished. Having entered in the second jhana, rapture born of concentration, free from directed thought and evaluation, Sariputta remained free of attraction or aversion in regards to those qualities just mentioned. He wasn't attracted or he wasn't averse to any of them. Which means that he wasn't distracted by any of them. He remained independent, detached, released, dissociated, and free of any barriers arising from attraction or aversion. Again, that last sentence just refers to a well-concentrated mind. Having entered into the second jhana, Sariputta understood there is deeper concentration. He pursued this path, Buddha's obviously referring to the Eightfold Path, and realized deeper concentration. Sariputta, secluded from sensuality and from unskillful mental qualities, with the fading of rapture and remaining equanimous, mindful and alert, sensitive to pleasure in the body, entered and remained in the third jhana. That's such an important line. Notice he's not chasing after pleasure, but he's sensitive to pleasure. That's the essence of a mind that's united in his body, isn't it? That it is a sensitive mind. It is it's able to sense things without distraction or distortion or corruption. It's simply sensitive. Why? Because it's well concentrated. The mind and the body, including the sixth sense base, is functioning as it should from a mature human being standpoint, not from a distracted, immature standpoint.
In that sense, it just says he senses the pleasure, and that sensation is all.
That's it. It's not, I need more or I need less of it. It's just what's occurring. And isn't that the essence of being united in your body? Something occurs, whether it's a physical experience or a thought, and you're simply mindful of it. You're sensitive to what's occurring. In this case, sensitivity is pointing to the ability now to properly understand what's occurring through our sixth sense. The sixth sense base is our five physical senses and the sixth sense of consciousness. And awakened consciousness is established in right view and can evaluate correctly what's occurring without any eye making in it. Does that answer the question or the what you brought up? That's the essence of being sensitive in your body. It doesn't mean that you're reacting. It simply means you're present and you're using all of your senses free of distraction.
So okay. Does that mean that you're not using your five clinging aggregates to sense?
Yes, as you're...
You just sense it.
In that moment, you are free of the burden of the five clinging aggregates.
Right. The clinging part.
Yes, and why? Because there's no self-identification. The five clinging aggregates are simply a description of the personal experience of ongoing confusion, deluded thinking, and suffering that arises from self-identification.
Right.
And self-identification arises from ignorance of Four Noble Truths, from a lack of understanding how things truly are in the world. In that sense, it's an aspect of mindful mindlessness, meaning mindfulness means to hold in mind. So we're holding in mind qualities that lead to distraction or mindlessness.
Right.
Another great question, great comments. Thank you. Sariputta, secluded from sensuality and from unskillful mental qualities, with a fading of rapture and remaining equanimous, mindful, and alert, sensitive to pleasure in the body, entered and remained in the third jhana. The third jhana is characterized by the noble ones as equanimous, mindful, resting in a pleasant abiding. So again, this third jhana follows from recognizing and taking the skillful pleasure in seclusion. Our concentration deepens and we take pleasure and comfort in recognizing deepening concentration. We've all experienced that. And now our concentration increases. And what is the experience? It's simply a pleasant abiding. Again, nothing magical or mystical, but so significantly important that the Buddha refers to these jhanas continuously. We need to recognize. And so I'll ask the same question. Have you all experienced that, even if it's just momentary, an experience of that pleasant abiding?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's nothing superhuman or supernatural about it, is there? And it's entirely achievable through our meditation practice. And as we're learning here, and as we're learning through our own direct experience, it only deepens as we continue our practice. We only cease developing it is when we lose the practice or substitute something else for it. Something else that the Buddha cautioned against. To do this practice and you'll awaken. Don't embellish it in any way. And as you've all seen, the reason... What gives us, again, this self-encouragement is recognizing that it's working. So we've all experienced at least the first three levels of jhana, haven't we? And then, that's not... I don't mean to present it in a way that it should be seen as insignificant, because it's entirely significant. This works. That feeling of, in the third jhana, of a pleasant abiding... Once we recognize it, now we can build on it. And as we build on it, we're able to incorporate in a more understandable and meaningful way the entire Eightfold Path. So again, we've had this discussion, all of us have talked about this, how we're and especially going through the course again, how we're understanding the details of all these different teachings in a much deeper way than when we first heard it, or when we, the second time or the third or the fourth time we went through these things. And that's really what a dedicated Dhamma practice is about. And so as a group, we've all gone through the book three or four times, and you're all seeing deeper levels of the same teaching. And recognizing that the effectiveness of it is an important part of continuing Dhamma practice. Yeah, I'm skipping over some of my comments. Sariputta, wise, of great, deep, and penetrating discernment, clearly saw the arising, the establishment, and the passing away of these mental qualities present in the third jhana. So again, even though these are profound developments, they're all impermanent, and they're nothing to cling to or self-identify with. In other words, wow, and the reason why I'm saying this too is the few times that I heard jhana mentioned outside of the Buddhist teachings, they were always taught as very mystical teachings that only super experienced meditators ever achieve. The Buddha's teaching that these are ordinary experiences of an extraordinary meditation practice. And they're all impermanent. Even these different levels of jhana arise and pass away. In the third jhana, the notice the arising and the passing away of these mental qualities present in the third jhana. He noticed how these qualities arose, came into play, and vanished. Having entered in the third jhana, equanimous, a pleasant abiding, with the qualities of concentration, sensory contact, feelings, perceptions, intention, consciousness, desire, decisions, persistence, mindfulness, equanimity, attention were recognized one after another. In other words, it's just this train of thought is arising and passing away. Sariputta remained free of attraction or aversion in regards to these qualities. He remained independent, detached, released, dissociated, and free of any barriers arising from attraction or aversion. Having entered into the third jhana, Sariputta understood there is yet deeper concentration. He pursued this path and he realized deeper concentration. Furthermore, with the abandoning of joy and distress, and with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, Sariputta entered and remained in the fourth jhana. So that is about as clearly a clear definition of the fourth, of entering the fourth jhana. We stop all self-referential views. I like this, I don't like that. This is painful, this is not painful. And in our meditation practice, and again, it might just be for a moment, when we free ourselves of that type of eye-making, Lorna described it just earlier, we enter and remain in the fourth jhana. The fourth jhana is characterized by the purity of equanimity. So it's just a deeper level of that experience of calm abiding from the third level. It's just deepening concentration. Purity of equanimity and refined mindfulness. There is no evaluation regarding pleasure or pain. Sariputta, wise, of great, deep, and penetrating discernment, clearly saw the arising, the establishment, and the passing away of these mental qualities present in the fourth jhana. He noticed how these qualities arose, came into play, and vanished. Having entered and remained in the fourth jhana, established in equanimity, abandoning pleasure and pain, internal calm, a pleasant abiding, the qualities of concentration, sensory contact, feelings, perceptions, intention, consciousness, desire, decision, persistence, mindfulness, equanimity, attention were recognized one after another. Again, those are all, some of those are skillful qualities, some are unskillful mental qualities that the Buddha is referring to, but they're all fabricated.
But they're all still there.
Yes, but they're just flowing.
They're just flowing.
They're now no longer a cause for distraction. Why? Because we stop evaluating them. We stop analyzing them. We stop any sense of I making with them. They're just what's flowing.
It's also saying that it's not a trance state.
Yes.
These things are arising and passing away. It's not just a blank place.
Thank you for that. It's so important that we have such a misunderstanding of meditation, even within this practice, that we think the point is to develop this trance-like state. But the whole purpose of the Buddha's teachings is to unite a mind in its body. A trance-like state, think about it just for a moment, is a mind that is completely ununited or disjoint from its body. That's the definition of a trance, isn't it? The reason why the Buddha taught a meditation practice solely for deepening concentration is for that same reason, so that we're simply not distracted by human thought that is always flowing. As awake, alive human beings, thoughts are flowing just as much as our heart is always pumping blood. And for most of us, our heart does not distract us. We're not mindful of our blood pumping all every minute. That's how we should treat our thoughts, but we don't, because we self-identify. There are some conditions, maybe phobia is not the right word, where people are distracted by their heartbeat. In other words, they can't not think about their heart beating. That's the same thing as becoming distracted with our thoughts, except we don't see it as a phobia or a malady, yet we spend our whole lives distracted by thoughts that do not require our constant attention. Bonnie, you had your hand up.
So part of what you say, or maybe you don't say it anymore when we enter into the beginning of meditation, is to acknowledge what arises, right? So when we acknowledge what arises, I don't mean to respond and react to it, but we have to see it in order to know that this is something that's arising. So isn't that still then, do you not do that in the fourth state, or you do it, but you just allow it to be and not respond to it? I mean, cause
yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Yep. Notice the arising and the passing away of your breath and your body.
Mm-hmm.
And so as we deepen our, that gets us going towards deeper jhana. But as concentration increases, that falls away too. And we're simply in that pleasant abiding of continual equanimity.
It's like you're fully engaged and you're not clean. So there's a clarity.
Yeah, that's
it's
a good
not
way.
A knowledge, and it's full engagement. It's you're seeing it clearly.
Yes, without any tension that would arise from self-reference.
Of acknowledging what might arise. It might
yes.
be sadness, it might be pleasant. It might be but something arises from the thoughts that are flowing, possibly.
I might be getting a little bit too semantic with this, but the thoughts and the feelings, just like we're going to look at this a little deeper. That's why the book is sequenced this way. We're going to look at this a little bit deeper in relation to the four foundations of mindfulness, where the Buddha teaches first to be mindful of the breath and the body. Then from that level of concentration, notice that feelings arise and pass away. Thoughts arise and pass away. So the feeling or the thought or the combination of the two might feel like sadness or joy or anger or fear, etc., etc., etc. In meditation, we're training ourselves to not be distracted by any of those feelings that arise. So in that way, using that description that Lorna gave us, our thoughts and our feelings are here, and our mind, our mindfulness is on our breath, which is up here. So thoughts are flowing, and we're training ourselves both on our cushion and off our cushion to not be distracted by or reacting to our thoughts and our feelings. Why? Because we've ceased self-identifying with our feelings. And how, the best example of that type of thinking is people ask how you're doing and you describe how you're feeling. Well, I had a rough day. This happened and that happened. Most of us do describe ourselves to others and to ourselves in relation to whatever quality our mind is in at the moment or whatever we're feeling at the moment, because we personalize those things. The best answer to how am I doing is...
Well, but then is that not acknowledging what might be arising?
No.
So just clarifying, we're talking about now the state of meditation. Yes.
Yes, but it also carries through, hopefully, off our cushion. That, and it's not a an avoidance of what's occurring. In other words, it's not. I'm not going to feel anything. In fact, it's just the opposite. It's feeling everything that's occurring at a profoundly deep level, but not reacting to it because you don't take it personal. So it might look the same to some people, that you're avoiding what's occurring, but the internal experience, the internal assurance is, for the first time in my life, I am deeply involved in my own life. Why? Because I'm feeling everything. And the only way that's possible to feel everything that's occurring is to not have any aversion or attraction towards something other than what's occurring.
So acknowledging what's coming up without clinging to perhaps how you might have responded, maybe distracting from it because it's intolerable or because you're craving to be distracted to not feel it.
Yeah, and that craving for the distraction is part of a conditioned thinking. We are deconditioning our minds. So situations that we know are going to come up tomorrow that used to bring us great fear or anxiety no longer do, even though the situation is the same. Why? Because we've gained control of our minds. That's what a mind united in its body, that's how it's experienced.
Even in all of the descriptions of jhana, sensory contact is one of the things that's arising. So going back to, it's not a trance state. I'm my body is contacting the cushion. I'm aware of sensation. I'm aware of feeling. I'm aware of all of those things arising. Through, even in a place where there's directed thought, and I'm seeing myself in action moving away from the sensation of breathing in the body and into self-identification, to the fourth jhana where that's not happening anymore. But sensory contact is still arising, is still there.
But you understand that it's impermanent.
Yes.
And it's not personal.
Exactly.
It's an aggregate. Not clinging.
Yes.
Yeah, and so then our senses are no longer contributing to our own ignorance and wrong views. They're simply being utilized the way that they're meant to be fully engaged with the world. So one of the things that
empty of what isn't there.
Yeah, empty of what's yes. One of the things that what did you say?
I said, don't complicate things.
Well, the Buddha did teach us that we should be, the whole point of the Buddha's teaching on emptiness is that we should empty ourselves of ignorance and be mindful of what isn't there, which is wrong views and ignorance. The seeming paradox, what concerns people when they first start getting an idea of where this teaching is going is that it feels like annihilation. How am I going to function without my views, without my self-referential views? Aren't they necessary for me to function in the world? When the truth of the matter is, no. In fact, we as human beings function much better when we're not constantly overly concerned about what's happening to me and simply experience life as life occurs. So whenever I talk about this, I can't help but think of something that happened, I think, as our very first retreat, when I was talking about this idea of a proper view of self and a not self characteristic and a mind going that way that we're talking about. It sounds like there's no such thing as a self, which is not what this is, and the Buddha never taught that. But the question was, well, what do you do if you're on the train tracks and the train's coming at you? Like, well, you shouldn't have any thoughts of self. You just get hit by the train. The answer is you take two steps to the right because you know what to do. That's not eye-making. It's just sensible, isn't it? The Buddha awakened at the age of 35. It wasn't eye-making that caused him to eat food every day. It was simply sensible. And he didn't do it out of out of gluttony or anything else. He simply did it because a human being needs nourishment. Maybe I got a little bit off track there, but Sariputta remained independent, detached, released, dissociated, and free of any barriers arising from attraction or aversion. Having entered into the fourth jhana, Sariputta understood there is deeper concentration. So the Buddha taught that there's four levels of jhana, but even that fourth level of jhana can deepen. There is deeper concentration. I got a call about a year and a half ago from an online student that it put me back on my heels a little bit because I've never asked a question. He says, why did Buddha keep meditating after he awakened? But of course, you look into that question a little bit, he was seeing meditation as a way to acquire something or probably a little bit of a burden. So why would anybody want to do it once they achieved the goal? But why wouldn't you want to do it? There is ever deepening levels of concentration. And Sariputta understood that. Furthermore, Sariputta abandoned self-identification with physical form. He abandoned self-identification with external forms, and perceptions of aversion disappeared. Now Sariputta perceives a dimension of infinite space. So here, these aren't to be seen as deeper levels of concentration. The Buddha refers to these non-physical realms in many other suttas, as will be seen here, as simply ways of attempting to establish the self in non-physical realms that are all fabricated and rooted in continued eye-making. Much of this type of spiritual practice occurred during the Buddha's time, and it's still prevalent today to establish yourself.
Could you explain that?
The sequencing, or just the idea of establishing yourself in non-physical realms?
Establishing yourself in non-physical realms.
Yeah, the most spiritual practices, and you can look at, and I'm not putting any of them down, the idea that...
Do you mean like mysticism and...
Well, yes and no. Mystical and magical practices always want to establish the self, usually as a reward in some non-physical type of heaven.
Afterlife.
Most religions have that. Buddhism has it. It's called usually Tulsita heaven, and it's usually taught that if you gain enough merit in this life, you'll find yourself in a non-physical plane that is maybe prone to the awakening, or the largest... Buddhist religion in the world teaches that if a specific chant that you say over and over and over continuously, and if you die with this chant on your lips, you'll immediately be taken to this Tulsita heaven, where forever and ever and ever you'll be taken care of by Abhidhamma Buddha. Sounds like a great deal, doesn't it? And it may be true. I'm not saying that it's not. It's just not something that the Buddha taught. The Buddha taught a Dhamma for human beings who engaged in it wholeheartedly to awaken right here, right now, not in some speculative and suppositional future non-physical realm. Did that answer your question?
I understand all of what you said. I guess I didn't realize that's what you were saying.
but even more than that, and even more subtle than that, anytime we attempt to establish ourselves in our imagination as the best this or the best that, the world's greatest meditator, the world's greatest Buddhist, the world's greatest baker, whatever it might be, we're establishing or attempting to establish a self in a speculative, non-physical realm, isn't it? It's all in our head. So the idea that I'm the best so-and-so or I'm the worst so-and-so is the same speculation as I'm going to do this and establish myself in infinite consciousness or infinite space. It's all the same thing. It's all a fabrication. Is that clear? Again, think about the purpose of the Buddha's Dhamma is to unite a mind in the body, the essence of mindfulness. Establishing myself outside of the body is the antithesis of that, isn't it? And yet, most modern Buddhist religions and most all religions attempt to do just that as some form of goal or reward to do things, if you do things right. The Buddha never, again, you heard me say this many times, the Buddha never saw himself as a savior. He didn't hope to teach a salvific religion. He simply wanted to teach people a way to recognize their own individual contribution to pain and suffering and confusion. How do you do it? with a well-concentrated mind in an Eightfold Path. Sariputta perceives a dimension of infinite space. I'm going to skip ahead a little bit because instead of going through all of those. The qualities present in a dimension of infinite space, the perception of the dimension of infinite space, concentration, sensory contact, etc., were all recognized one after another as fabricated mind states. And the typical non-physical realms that were often mentioned during the Buddhist time and still today, of nothingness, infinite consciousness, neither perception nor non-perception, Sariputta noticed, I'll read from that, noticed how these qualities arose, came into play, and vanished. All of these common self-seeking non-physical establishments Sariputta was aware of, he recognized them and dismissed them as fabricated one after another. And that's the important teaching here. Sariputta remained free of attraction and aversion in regards to even those qualities. He remained independent, detached, released, dissociated, and free of any barriers arising from attraction and aversion. Having abandoned the perception of the dimensions of infinite space, of nothingness, of infinite consciousness, or neither perception nor non-perception, Sariputta understood there is deeper concentration. In other words, he discarded those just as he did the other fabricated mind states. He pursued this path and realized deeper concentration. Furthermore, Sariputta, having abandoned the perception of the dimension of neither perception nor non-perception, he entered in those other dimensions. He entered and remained in the cessation of perception and feelings. The cessation of perception and feelings. In relation to what we're talking about, it doesn't mean that he no longer has the ability to perceive or to feel, but they're no longer rooted in fabrications because his mind is now well concentrated. He entered and remained in the cessation of perception and feelings rooted in ignorance. Sariputta remained independent, detached, released, dissociated, and free of any barriers arising from attraction or aversion. He now understood there is no deeper concentration. He pursued this path and realized there is no deeper concentration. He finally realized that place of profound and unwavering concentration. The Buddha continues, if any person were to speak rightly and with skill, were to say Sariputta has attained mastery and perfection of noble virtue, noble concentration, and noble wisdom, the Buddha is referring to the Eightfold Path there, Sariputta has attained mastery and perfection of the threefold noble eightfold path and has attained noble release. If any person were to speak rightly and with skill were to say, Sariputta is born of the Buddha's words. In this way, he is the Buddha's son, his offspring. Sariputta is born of the Dhamma and has become awakened from the Dhamma. His inheritance is not of worldly things. I love that line. His inheritance is my Dhamma. Sariputta, my friends, has taken the wheel of the Dhamma set rolling by me, and he keeps it rolling authentically. I'm sorry, he keeps it rolling in authenticity. This is what was said by the great teacher. Those gathered were delighted by his words. That's the end of the sutta. Thank you for listening. So, an incredibly powerful sutta, especially the way he concludes it. And the Buddha relating Sariputta, who he had met just maybe 3 or 4 weeks earlier than he gave this sutta, probably, as his son, and that his son received his inheritance, and the inheritance was his Dhamma. And not to be overly dramatic, and I hope I'm not being that way, but here we are 2,600 years ago still receiving the inheritance from that great teacher. And it's still useful and effective, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It still makes sense. We still know how to apply it. We still know how to use it to simply deepen concentration. What a remarkable sutta. Let's go around the room. Please ask any questions you want about the sutta. You're going, Keila? Good to see you, lady. So nice to see you again.
Good night.
I hope to see you both soon. And maybe let's talk a little bit about how you're understanding of samatha, vipassana, meditation within the broader framework is for just deepening concentration and how that's developing for you. So, Matt, good to see you.
John, good to see you. Good to see everybody. Yeah, every time we come and go over the truth of happiness, I've found that my meditation practice has gotten stronger, meaning more concentrated. Yeah, you know, when viewed in the context of just developing concentration, I've noticed over these last 6 years that that's what's happened. So I don't have too much more to add, you know. The method is obviously good.
Yeah.
And so it bears fruit if you do it.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that's the whole catch to it. You just have to do it, but it's entirely practical and effective. So Lorna, good to see you.
Thank you. Something Matt said a few weeks ago really kind of like brought it home to me that all our fabrications that we have of ourselves in our mind will end one day. They will end. When we die, when we pass away, they'll all go, they'll all end.
Yep.
Which brings it to the point when they are going to end, well, why not end them now?
Yeah.
You know?
That's why not?
Because
cow's gonna get us.
It's inevitable, and life will go on when all my fabrications
yeah.
have died. And it just kind of like brings this stupid reality of it all home to you that it's all a waste of time anyway, because it's all gonna die anyway. So you can look at it that way. And sometimes when I think about the Dharma and fabrications, I can see that it's just a thought in my head. That's it. That's all a fabrication is, really. It's
yeah.
just a thought in my head. And sometimes I sort of like bring myself down to earth again with just seeing that a fabrication is just the thought in my head. That's all it is.
That's all.
And then just very quickly, I will mention that I was getting a bit distracted on my cushion a while ago, a few months ago this happened. What I started doing was when I meditate on the cushion at home, I have a tablet, iPad, and I sometimes play your recordings, or there's others you can do with just gong sounds, etc., just as a timer. But I started like doing the meditation, then I go on the iPad and blah, 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 blah. On the iPad, whilst I was still sitting on the meditation cushion, after a few weeks of doing that, I realized that the meditation cushion wasn't as sacred is right the right word, but it wasn't just my special place to go to meditate. It was becoming a place of meditation and then distraction time.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and the two kind of like were blending into one another. And so I when I realized what I was doing, I still wanted to meditate with the iPad, so I kind of rearranged the room to start again in another spot. And I only use the iPad for meditation on the cushion. And it's like a little rule I've built in to my practice. If I want to look at something on the iPad and check my emails later or something like that, well, I get up and I move.
Yeah.
I physically move to another chair or another place in the room or another room or something, and then I check my emails, blah, blah, blah. Because I was getting to the point that they were kind of like the distraction of the iPad and what the information on the iPad was a distraction whilst I was meditating. So I got a bit confused, but as I say, that was a few months ago, and I've corrected it, and I'm now, I know it's a rule to my, you know, you learn as you go along, it's a rule, you must keep your meditation cushion for meditation, period. Nothing else.
Yeah.
So I've kind of learned that a few months ago. Right. I just said that.
Yeah, I guess so. What
just
a great example
we're
of right
about
effort.
Meditation, so
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's self-discipline. So
yeah.
Thank you for sharing that with all of us. You know, we'll all benefit. Let me ask, invite Jane on first as we're going around. Hello, Jane.
Hi, John.
How are you?
I'm well. I had a very busy day today.
Oh.
And, in the past, it's the kind of day that I know I would have found very stressful.
Yep.
And I became aware, as I'm going to thing to thing, that I felt a sense of peace, very, very much calmer than I, you know, would have in the past.
Isn't that wonderful?
So I can only attribute that to my Dharma practice, so
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that with us. That really is a point. It sounds almost too simple, but isn't that what we all want? To go through life and be able to be calm and at peace, no matter what's occurring. So, thank you. I see you signed up for the retreat, too. I'm glad you did.
Yes.
Let me invite iPad on. Where are you? Hello, iPad.
Do
you?
Laying all over the cushion.
I don't think it's loaded. Hello, iPad. Do you? Who are you? Do you want to give us your name? No. Okay.
My name is iPad.
Okay, well, iPad, I'm glad you could join us. We'll move on to Andrew. Andrew, good to see you.
You asked earlier whether our practice, having done it now for a while, has gotten simpler in any way. In my experience, it hasn't really gotten simpler. It's just that the recognition that distraction is part of the process. And then going back has made me more tolerant about the fact that there are always distractions, but it can't come back. So it's not simpler, but it's more tolerable.
Well, and it's important to recognize that. I mean, that's a developing meditation practice. Developing concentration practice, so good for you.
Mm-hmm. You got the first noble truth.
Yeah.
Distraction occurs.
Excuse me, John, I have to excuse myself early.
That's fine, I'm glad you made it tonight. We'll see you soon. Yeah. Please say hello to Judy.
Good night.
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 We can put stuff away.
We'll put your,
yeah.
Good night, Andrew.
Good to see you, Ram.
Mm. Yeah, every time I hear this sutta, and then it's been a couple of times that I've really started to hear it, it's made my meditation practice less frustrating, and I realize that I've spent a lot of time in frustration in my meditation practice.
Mm-hmm.
Always thinking, I'm not doing it right, and I'm not understanding what's going on, and this sutta in particular, and the way you're teaching it, it just as is chasing out a whole bunch of cobwebs.
Good.
Because a lot of it comes from just wrong view.
Yeah.
Just didn't look at it in the right perspective. And I also realized there's more, and still have to clear out some more stuff. To be able to sit down and meditate and not spend most of it in frustration, that's a real gift.
Yeah, it is.
So
yeah. Thank you, Ron. That's so important to do that, to be gentle with ourselves, not judge ourselves harshly. If we're engaging in this simple practice, we're doing it right. You know, and then we can recognize the ever-deepening levels when we get past judging ourselves in that way,
and hearing it in the right language too is an important thing, because all these descriptions of what those jhanas are supposed to be are really easily misunderstood.
Yeah.
And I did it for a long time.
Yeah, and they're just simple and directly experience. Mm. You know, to be honest. Thank you. Helen, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Thank you. Good to be here. Sorry I missed last week.
We
I was
too.
Away. The way I see the jhanas is like a train ride, and you are aware that you're sitting in your seat and you're near the window. I've mentioned this before. You're going down and the images are passing, and in the beginning maybe you're looking, you know, cow, tree, and you're paying attention, and then after a while, you know, you go a few more miles and you realize you haven't really been focused on that anymore. You've just sort of been peacefully enjoying the ride, and you know, it gets to be a blur and it's not a distraction at all anymore. So I kind of see that you go through these different levels like that. And so sometimes you're counting cows. Sometimes you're wondering if the one lying down is trying to tell everyone else it's going to rain. And then sometimes you're just there and you're aware that you're there, and it's just a sort of peaceful feeling. So that's how I view it.
Good way to view it. Thank you. Kate, good to see you.
Good to see you. Two things. So I just started my meditation practice. I haven't been doing it very long. And when I always tried to do it before, I would get really frustrated because I was going for that trance-like state,
yep.
and I could never get there. My
good.
Thoughts were constantly flowing. I couldn't turn them off, and it was just so frustrating to me because that's what I thought I was supposed to be doing, was getting this blank mind state. So when I read in your book a few pages in, we're conscious beings, thoughts are supposed to be flowing, you know, you kind of just let them go by. I thought, okay, that was like such a relief because I thought, I can do that. I just can't turn them off. So that's really helped me kind of settle into it a little bit. And one of the things that you said tonight, I think one of the jhanas, is that what they're called?
Yeah.
Is that pleasure you get when you disentangle yourself from the world. That's what I feel. Totally. Like, even though it's fleeting, I just, it feels so good for a second just to like shut it off.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm enjoying about it so far.
That's
so.
Great. That's, thank you for sharing that. And that is, even though it's fleeting, it's worth the price of admission, isn't it?
Yeah, totally.
And that really is the point. That's what we build on, and it's also where we end up, is living a life with that quality of mind, moment by moment, just at peace. And there is no greater accomplishment. There can't be. You know, so.
It has a cumulative effect.
Yeah.
Which is nice.
But in order to accumulate it, we have to recognize it along the way. That's really the point of all these teachings on jhana. Just recognize that it's working, and you, that was a perfect description of it working. So, thank you.
Thank you. And I also have to go because I'm about to lose my sitter, so thank you.
Uh-oh. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
See you again
thank
soon.
Thank you so much.
Good night.
Good night.
Mary, good to see you.
Good to be here.
Kate.
Something she said, I remember, you know, going through this maybe the second time and really hearing that meditation is for concentration, you know, hearing that a little bit differently. And then the repetition of the meditation practice, you know, deepens the concentration, combined with the deeper that is, the more integration you have off the cushion, and then recognizing when that's happening. And that, very simply, that's sort of what it is, right? And you're integrating it from here to there, and then more frequently in the real world, in all your experiences, you're bringing this, and all of a sudden it's not compartmentalized anymore. It's just how you are and who you are.
Yeah, what a great way of putting it. Thank you. Yeah, it's not just, it's not a practice that you're doing. It's just what you are. Thank you. David, good to see you.
I think I'll pass.
Glad you're here. Bonnie, how are you tonight? It's good to see
Thank
you.
Thank you. It's good to be here. I think for all the years of practice and coming to it, like I'm a fidget and I like can't sit still, but somehow when I meditate, there's the stillness. So sometimes I try to remember that I can do that to acknowledge you know, that energy. But I think for my practice of meditation, I have grown to be more patient and tolerant of my humanness, and not being harsh, and allowing, especially during the meditation, to allow life as it occurs in my cushion. And that's really, I remember going to meditation and doing all kinds of what you thought was meditation, or going to a day of silence and being like, oh my God, am I nuts? This is way too much. I can't even think about it. Nobody would talk to me, you know. But to looking at years ago and then where I am, I think, you know, it is so cumulative. It's like a mind that is, you know, it's when we learn something, our mind, you can never put back what broadened or opened your mind.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
But I think the kindness, the compassion, and to hear, I mean, it doesn't mean that I don't say some things internally, but that I, you know, just much more aware of, you know, the using the Eightfold Path to you know, to let that flow like my thoughts a little bit more. So that's been, I think also when you in the first few years of being here, you could see, sometimes I could really see like the benefits, like, or like, wow, like, I could feel like what Kate was saying, just the release of, like, you know, finally, like, you're, it's a relief to be on your cushion and then to use it up. But I think then there comes a point where the subtleties of what you learn, and you kind of get a little bit more murky, and I think, so doing this again, it allows, you know, for cleaning your glasses, some more clarity.
Mm.
Just becomes, and sometimes it's like crystal clear. It's like, and then it goes away again. But, you know.
Like what?
When you go to the doctor and they take your glasses off and they line up your eyes, you know, and they tell me when you, like, you know, they're like, you know, when it really lines up and the machine takes your prescription, that's sort of what it's like.
Yeah.
It's crystal clarity, and then, oh, wait, what? Okay. Okay, it's there somewhere. But thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Again, it's worth the price of admission, isn't it?
And that's
all. Liz, good to see you.
Good to see you too. I remember when I first realized that there didn't have to be mysticism in meditation, and how grateful I was, because it was never anything I was able to accomplish through other practices. So I was sort of relieved that it wasn't yet another thing I needed to try to achieve, or, you know, that this was very simple. And Dave and I had this great conversation over the holidays about how it becomes integrated when you can say that if you sort of, and this is just my interpretation and an application to my process, but if you slip out of, off the path, you simply get back on the path.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's all you need to do.
You could say that's why the Buddha taught a path, so we notice no one were off it.
Right.
You know, if there wasn't,
mm-hmm.
we wouldn't know, would we?
But you don't get punished for being off of it.
Right.
Right,
but you also know how to get back on.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, that's huge.
It is.
Sometimes there's some sharp turns on the path.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
And sharp
double,
stones.
You gotta double back.
Yep.
Sometimes there's mud.
Distraction makes the room blind.
It really is.
It's not.
The significant difference between, well, religions in general, and then what the Buddha taught, and what most other people who we might say are in some way enlightened. Drew asked this question a while ago, and again, I think I've said this a few times, but I didn't quite take his reference. I think the question was like, are you saying that the Buddha was the only awakened person? and it just depends on what your description is of what awakened or enlightened is. But he's the only one that I've come across that taught a very specific path on how to do it, rather than saying this is how an enlightened person should be, meaning that I should be compassionate, or I should be calm, I should be peaceful, I should be all loving. Well, I don't know how to do it. You know, I like to think that I could just hear those words and do it, but I can't. The Buddha realized that too, so he taught that path, that when we fall off the path, we can come back on and continue to develop that. And a human being of our contemporary, Jiddu Krishnamurti, is someone who I would say was an awakened human being. And he often attributed the Buddha's teachings to helping him. But the thing that was lacking in him and not lacking in the Buddha was Jiddu did not teach a path. He simply taught a conceptual way of how we should be as awakened human beings. And he was a remarkable man, and his readings are still worth reading, but he didn't teach a path. And in all of the different Buddhist schools, there is no Eightfold Path. There's substitutions for the path for that type of Dharma practice, but no path.
But I think the point, not but, and I think the point that Dave was making and that we've talked about in class before is that you can bypass the second arrow at any point in time and just get right back on and not beat yourself up for having wandered off or gotten upset about something. So that's the practical nature of all this.
Yeah. Thank you for saying that. It's so important to realize. We don't have to be, and we likely won't be, perfect in this, and we won't likely always engage in right effort. But the point of continuing practice, in fact, is one of the benefits of having a well-focused sangha, is it's a reminder about how to get back on the path.
Mm-hmm. And something else you said, and I've said this before too, is where there is conflict, there is ignorance.
Yeah.
And where there's ignorance, you're not on the path.
Yeah.
You know, and everybody grows up differently about conflict, right?
Yeah.
And so realizing where there's conflict, there's ignorance, you're off.
Yeah.
Like that's pretty powerful.
Yeah, and it's also very simple if we leave out harsh judgments, because a harsh judgment of, oh, I'm off the path again, what a fool I am, is just going to keep you further from the path.
Mm-hmm.
And really, it's actually a very powerful and subtle strategy to just continue ignoring the path, because, you know, you're not worth it, or you're whatever that might be. And that underlying self-loathing is part of ignorance. Sometimes it's hard to see, sometimes it's quite obvious. But it's always an underlying aspect of I need more, I need to fix a broken cell, I need to always be acquiring things. It's all part of it.
The path is such a lovely path. I don't know why anybody wouldn't
want to
be on it.
Yeah. It's hard to understand that, yet when the Buddha started teaching, he realized that this is something that is hard to see. It's
mm-hmm.
abstruse. It's difficult because of conditioned thinking, because a mind rooted in ignorance will create very powerful and subtle strategies to ignore its own ignorance, including a spiritual practice.
It's challenging you to push the fog away
and to
face the
to
possibility that this cloud that you're living in isn't true.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that the path allows you to structure yourself in a way where it's letting you develop that concentration to see it clearly, to see it as what your reality is. And that's the beauty. And it's an intertwining path because they support each other. You have to have right view, but you have to have the concentration to develop that wisdom. So it there is just a beauty, and then there's the checks of the virtue factors.
Yeah,
it's just a simple, beautiful thing you came up with.
It's remarkable.
It's remarkable. It truly is self-supporting, and it's an entire thing. You can't do seven.
Yeah, and you can't do nine either.
No,
but I mean,
you can't do nine.
What I'm saying is if you embellish it in any way, thinking that, well, I need to add something to it, I need to add a chanting practice, or, you know, that's an aspect of eye-making there. You've just lost the whole thing by doing that. He taught a complete, comprehensive Eightfold Path. It stands on its own, and we must treat it that way.
And that's the beauty of, like, the three gems, because he gives you the example of himself in Sarvabuddha, and he gives you the Dhamma, and he gives you the Sangha that's surrounding you to see that it's a path. It's a gradual path. It's not everyone's going to be struck down by enlightenment. It's a path. So it's a beautiful thing he developed, and he made it practical.
Yeah.
And that's the truly the beautiful part of it, is that he took that time to figure out how to make it practical for everyone.
Yeah, upon his awakening. I mean, he thought hard. It's funny, I'm responding to something that was published in Tricycle Magazine last month, and in this other person's article, he uses the fact that the fable, is how he put it, of the Buddha's indecision after his awakening about teaching is something that shows that we should dismiss everything that the Buddha... His whole point of his article is that we should dismiss the suttas because, you know, the Buddha was not a human being, he was a god, etc., etc. And that's one of the points that he makes. If he was so full of this indecision, how could we even consider that anything he had to teach was worthwhile? The point is that he was a human being,
right,
and seriously considered, out of great compassion and courage, how can I pierce this veil of ignorance? And, you know, again, I'm gonna submit it to Tricycle. So
I have seen your responses to things in the past.
Yeah, it's been a while.
I'm always like,
it's been a while. It's very frustrating and in some cases disheartening to read what's put out there. But I came across this, and I happen to know who this teacher is. And it's unfortunate that they made it their cover story, but it really is.
But they do it for a reason. You know, they do it
to
create some kind
of... Oh, yeah, and they have a...
conflict.
Yeah. Well, it's not just that. They I don't want to get into the blame game.
No,
but
don't want to forget Kevin back here.
Oh, I'm saving the best for last. The Yeah, let's get to Kevin, good to see you.
Nice to see you too. Nice to be here with everybody. I think you asked about what our meditation practices taught us. Is that what we're
Yes.
Well, the meditation practice has taught me that the concentration developed on the cushion is to be applied in the real world, or in the phenomenal world. And I think that there's a process that we experience that pleasant body on the cushion, then we experience it in the phenomenal world. And I really liked what David said, and that's what I was sort of thinking, is that that concentration allows the path to become visible, you know, and we see it. And when we're off it, we come back on it, as we've just said, and each one of the eight factors is the wisdom, the three virtues factor. The factors, but rather the eight you know, pieces of the path are almost sort of guideposts that we've all put in the ground at one point, and we may be somewhere on the path, and you have to go back and, you know, weeds grow, the post is still there, it's wood, it gets worn away. I mean, I'd rather use post than a stone for this metaphor, so to speak. So we have to go back and tend to the areas of the path that might need to be cleaned up. Then once we do that, they're able to, you know, be embodied, and we're able to really check in with them. And if there isn't, if there's something better than that and having that insight and concentration, then I probably won't be spending my time here. But, you know, I don't think there is. So
yeah, I don't either.
That's why we continue on the path, and like we said, it's to, you know, we're going to be on and off it. You know, you hope to not be, but it's impossible. You know, the distraction and worldly events are going to keep going on, so it's best to keep checking in you know, David just said, it's very practical, and I've felt that what you put into your practice is what's going to be most practical in your life. So that's why you meditate, and that's why we come back to it. And if our practices are not how we want them to be, we will keep sitting and we'll keep practicing Shamatha Vipassana and develop that mindfulness, so we'll notice when we're there. And
okay.
That's why we keep spinning the wheel of truth and get the Buddha set in motion. So that's all I got.
Wow. Thank you, wise man. That's great. Yeah. I'm not sure if Mr. iPad wants to be bothered, but he seemed to have fallen out of the room. Oh, it's Frank.
Huh.
How come it says, how are you, Frank?
Well, we have
Wait a
nickname.
Minute. Do you have your microphone on?
Frank,
I guess I don't think your microphone is on. Well, I'm so glad to see you. Everybody's been asking about you. When are you coming back to our Sangha? Make it too easy. What's that?
I didn't say anything.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, if Frank doesn't have his mic, come out. Frank, I'm so glad you joined us. Give me a call. Let's have a talk. Great class. Thank you all. I think you all got the announcement about the registration for the retreat is open. Please, as soon as you decide you're going, please register. It helps me tremendously. And there is only one single room left, Lorna. So if you want that, you better sign up quick, Lorna. And
or you might end up in the
in our room.
Yeah. Because the
Sister Gaggle.
Yeah. Because all that right speech that always goes on at retreat. The Juan Dharma Center has gotten much busier, so we know we only have the use of one building now. It's been this way since last year too, so there's only one quad room available to us. Unless I can guarantee, I think I have to guarantee 30 participants in order to secure both buildings, so I'm not going to do that yet. So my thinking is that alternating retreats, the quad room will be for women, and then the next retreat for men. So the spring retreats, the quad room is for women. In the fall, it'll be for men. So if you're of that gender and want a quad bed, I would suggest you do, you reserve that as soon as you can. But again,
you can turn the downstairs into a dorm.
But again, I don't want you to sign up if you're not sure you're going to make it, but as soon as you're sure, please sign up, because it does help me with a lot of different things.
John, please remind me of the dates.
May 16th to May 19th. Yeah, they're in the email, and it's in every email now,
okay.
And it's on the website. I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be similar to the last retreat, but each retreat seems to stand on its own too.
Mm-hmm.
Depending
on how people show up each time.
Yeah, there's going to be a few interesting folks this time, I think. Larry's going to be coming back. Remember Larry from two or three retreats ago. He signed up.
Cool.
Jane's coming back. So a few people that have come in from the past that are quite a distance away, I think, are going to show up. So we're going to have, it's always a wonderful time anyway, to deepen our understanding. I think that's it. It's gotten a little bit late, so we'll finish with metta, as we always do. So these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born. May all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class tonight.
Thank you,
Jane and Frank. See you all soon. Peace.
Thanks, John.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.